Katie.
Oh, hello. Decided to grace us with your presence, have you?
Yeah, it's been a while. I've missed you.
I've missed you too. What have you been doing?
Yeah, I'm currently in the middle of nowhere, living on a farm, making a piece of music theatre, a kind of queer feminist deconstruction of the role of the mother figure in the Catholic Mass.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
There's a lot going on there. A lot to unpack.
Whilst living amongst chickens and horses. It's like pretty idyllic, actually. I recommend it to anyone.
I'm very jealous. That sounds like exactly what I want to be doing right now.
Yeah, sadly, we've had to move into the hustle and bustle of the big city these last few days to rehearse. And we actually found ourselves, rather shockingly, being placed in a studio next door to people doing laughter workshops, which was like relatively traumatic to hear all day through the door.
What exactly is that? Is that sort of like laughter as exercise kind of thing?
Not necessarily as exercise, I don't think, but like as a communal activity to raise your spirits.
Oh, I actually did that once.
You did it?
Yeah, I joined a free workshop at the South Bank Centre in London, and it weirdly left me with not chest pain afterwards, but like quite sore ribs. It's a bit of a workout.
I can imagine.
That must have been an interesting environment to try and rehearse next to.
Yes, it was rather distracting when we were doing a very like meditative, peaceful piece of music theatre in the next door room. Anyway, what have you been up to, Katie?
Well, I had my French citizenship ceremony, which was very exciting.
Yay.
And it was really lovely. I wasn't expecting to be so moved by it. But our local mayor in my district, in my arrondissement, invited me and some other new French people to the town hall. And we all got a bunch of flowers and fizzy wine. And we sang the Marseillaise, which was, I was actually a little bit disappointed because I was really ready to sort of belt it out and sing my heart out. And as usual, at these public events, everyone was a bit mumbly and embarrassed to be singing. So they were like, but apart from that, it was really lovely. And I cried.
Oh, wow. That sounds really touching and like slightly strange as well to have to like get together and sing a national anthem.
Yeah, especially since the French national anthem is actually quite violent and has lines in it about slitting people's throats. It's a great tune, though.
It is a good tune. And actually, speaking of music, that is the reason we are here this week. We are going to be giving you a sneak preview of a new podcast series that is just about to launch. It launches tomorrow, actually.
The series is called Millennial History, and it looks at major moments in the recent past, as seen through the eyes of people who were just kids at the time. And the series features some really intimate and thought-provoking stories from around Europe, everywhere from Romania to Northern Ireland. And this first episode takes us to Sicily.
But there's something else we loved about this series. It's musicality. The voice you're about to hear is our friend Andrea Fuchs. Andrea is a musical journalist, a pretty unusual job title, but what it means is that she combines in-depth journalism with original music.
Yeah, I didn't actually know that musical journalism was a thing until I met Andrea. Like, I think she kind of invented it. Andrea has produced a series with the composer Luke Dean, and the series as a whole features more than 60 bands. It is a real pleasure to hear them.
So here we go. Episode 1 of Millennial History, brought to you by Resonant Productions in collaboration with our friends at Are We Europe. Episode 1 drops on the Millennial History feed tomorrow, and you can find full details of that whole series at millennialhistorypodcast.com.
That's it from us for now. We will leave you in Andrea and Luke's capable hands. See you next week, everyone.
I mean, I just find it really interesting.
Here. This is the talk about everything.
Because there's just so much to talk about.
Prove ourselves worthy of the majority.
Millennial History.
Hi everyone, welcome to Millennial History. In this podcast, we talk to millennials who lived big moments in the recent world history from up close. Together, we revisit their memories, put them in context, and investigate the impact that the events have had on their lives and view of the world. We start with Aki Spadaro from Sicily. In 1992, he was 5 years old when the mafia blew up the highway behind his house at the moment that Judge Giovanni Falcone drove over it. Falcone had put hundreds of mafia members behind bars in the decades before. Here is what you can expect.
And that was a shocking moment in the history of our country.
What is the biggest misconception that you hear around you?
About mafia?
Yeah.
That it's a fictional phenomenon. I would be glad if somebody would come to me and ask me some questions about mafia that are some real, that are connected to reality.
My name is Andrea Voets. I'm the artistic director of Resonate Productions. We make musical journalism by combining original interviews with lots of music. We want to bring to light emotional blind spots and start conversations about what matters. Aki is my friend we met during our studies in Amsterdam. All of the music you will hear has been offered by musicians from Sicily.
Creatività uccidi, ammazza e cancella ogni cosa come un fuoco che distrugge le semenze e come si fa.
I'm from Palermo, which is the biggest city in Sicily. I'm not from the city center, I'm from we call it Borgata Marinara, which is a neighbor that is near the beach, but in the summer is a hell. As a matter of fact, we are very unpredictable people, very unpredictable and very difficult to define. So if you walk in the street of Palermo, you can find somebody that has an approach to life that is maybe extremely strict and extremely consistent and extremely coherent. And that's somehow Sicilian attitude as well. And next to him, you find somebody that has never paid taxes in his life. That has this depth, maybe it translates into this unpredictability within people, let's say, within each other and even within themselves as persons. You know, so there is a certain inconsistency in behaviors and habits. Yes, there are still families that are controlling pieces of the territory. That's the term that we use.
What does that look like practically? To control territory in Sicily?
Well, it's very subtle in the sense that if you walk there as a tourist or as a visitor, that you don't see anything, or maybe you see things and you don't associate it to that. Let's put it this way, it's a city that has a lot of unemployment, but then if you go to a certain neighbor, you see somebody that is selling something illegally on the street, which can be sandwiches or... But if you think about it, why is that guy doing that and not somebody else? And why there and not somewhere else? Because somebody, some form of para-institution decides that that spot belongs to that person, and so this is how you control the territory. But of course, historically, the most important source of income of those association was the racket. We call it racket, which is asking money to the commercial activities for protection. It corresponds to taxation, it's taxes, basically. So that's how it is. It's very pragmatic. There's nothing fancy about it.
How do they come to collect these taxes? Just in cash?
Yeah, just in cash. There's somebody going around.
And if you say no?
Well, nowadays is different than in the past. In the past, it was dangerous to say no. They could have come to burn your... most commonly, they would have burned your shop or your restaurant or your bar. Or they would have intimidated you up to the point that you were too scared not to pay. They were protecting you from themselves, in fact. I remember, for instance, as a personal anecdote, once they stole my father's motorbike when he was having a drink. My father, the day later, went to the to this bar and told to the owner, well, I was having a drink here at your place and my motorbike got stolen. He was, of course, very, very sorry and said, I don't know, let's see what we can find out. And after nearly a week, my father receives a call from the police that tells him, we found your motorbike, it's parked here, I mean, not too far from the place. And we went there, and there was the motorbike in perfect condition, chained with a very good lock, with a very good chain. And that was a kind of a mysterious thing, if you think about it, because first of all, how did the police know that that was a stolen motorbike? What must have happened in that circumstance is that the owner of the place said, look, somebody harmed a customer of mine, and that is not in our agreement somehow. So they managed to track who stole the motorbike, and the police was informed of where the motorbike was by who stole it. And that was a shocking moment in the history of our country. In many ways, things can be... in the recent history of Italy, it's relevant whether something has happened before or after that. Moment of break.
Do that.
Because I want to be sure that the date was 23rd of May. I think it was
92, right?
92.
Yeah.
Okay. It was the afternoon of May 23rd, 1992. I was 5 years old. 5 years old. 5 years and a half. And I was at the house, at the countryside house of my grandparents, like where I was spending a lot of time in spring and in the summer. And we hear this very loud explosion coming from a concrete factory near the highway. We hear this very loud boom, and of course everybody started wondering what that would have been, and everybody thought that there was an accident in the factory. There was this cloud of smoke. It was strange. People were saying, yeah, it seems like a fact, but why a concrete factory should have such a big explosion? What do they have? They are not making fireworks. After not more than 2 hours, we turned on the television and we figured out that that was a bomb that killed the judge Giovanni Falcone, his wife, and 3 men of his guards. Judge Falcone was coming back from Rome, and they placed this unbelievable amount of explosive below the highway in a pipe that was going under the road, and they remotely activated the bomb with a remote control from the hill 300 or 400 meters above the point of the explosion. And the house of my grandparents was, I would say, less than a kilo, maybe 500 meters, 400 meters from the point of the explosion. So that was very clear, it was very loud. But I remember it perfectly. The highway was completely blown out. There was no road anymore. There was no road. There are the images of the first reporters who get there, and there was nothing. There was just soil and those cars completely destroyed. But it was a war zone. When the bomb exploded, the car that blew off completely was the car in front. And that car was completely wrecked, and it was very difficult to recompose the bodies. While the car of Giovanni Falcone, in fact, didn't blow up. The car of Giovanni Falcone hit against the wall of debris that were generated by the explosion. As a matter of fact, he was still alive. The traumas that he had were comparable to the one of a car accident, because he just hit against the debris. He arrived at the hospital that was still alive, and he died of trauma at his chest and his head, because he was also not wearing a safety belt. If he would have worn a safety belt, he would be alive, most likely. It's a way of operating that even for mafia was quite something, because the mafia has historically done its execution with the gun on the street. You know, this was a big thing. That was rather a terroristic method than a mafia method.
Or like theater.
Yeah, they wanted to make it big. They wanted to make it big.
How did they even physically manage? How?
Well, you just put a lot of explosive. You put a lot of explosive, and you have people that know how to do their job. That's, for instance, one of the controversies around those bombings, because they say you need an engineer to organize this properly. It's hard to believe that just some criminals that can barely speak Italian, read and write, can plan such a thing. It was a highly sophisticated plan. What sticks to my memory the most is the sound of the explosion. It's something that I have never heard before and after that.
Can you describe it?
When do you? Hey, it's like a thunder. It's like a thunder. It's a boom, very deep, very low, and very loud, and very short. I mean, when you're a kid, you cannot distinguish very well from what is common, what is regular, and what is exceptional. You just absorb it. So it was like, all right, that must be how it is. That was the first time that I heard about mafia. That was the first time that I heard about the bomb. It was the first thing that make me think in terms of what's behind my little kid's context. Because, you know, when you're a kid, what are you aware of? Of your family, of your friends, of the school, end of the story. Then what's behind, it doesn't concern you, you don't know. So that was the first thing that came from this outside world. I don't remember any news before that. I remember when my grandmother fell from the stairs, or, you know. So that's the first thing I remember of what happened outside my kid circle. I always say that that was the date of birth of my political and social consciousness. To the very core, let's say, that was the moment I knew, I realized there is a society. Giovanni Falcone was a crucial member of an anti-mafia pool of judges. One of them was Giovanni Falcone, one of them was Paolo Borsellino, that was killed the same way 20 days after.
The same way?
Yeah, with another explosion.
On the highway?
In the city center. That was even more violent. Even more violent. That was awful. That was awful. Paolo Borsellino and Giovanni Falcone were probably the most important members of this team of judges. Historically, that has an immense value because it's thanks to them that you can convict someone for being part of mafia. They opened the gate to what was called the maxi processo, a maxi trial. They basically managed to arrest some hundreds of heads of mafia, and they made the trial with all of them at the same time. It was one huge trial with hundreds of people. And in order to do that, they had to build a trial room. If you should Google it, it's called Aula Bunker. It's enormous and it's surrounded by cages. Because this was built attached to a jail, pictures of the trial that are impressive, where you see these hundreds of people in these cages all around. And that was, of course, very dishonorable. Revenge is an important element in the mafia culture. So it was an act of revenge. So that's why he was killed. Well, first of all, let's say there was no question anymore after this that mafia was a threat for the people. In the collective consciousness of people, this definitely made a switch. This definitely entered in people's mind, especially in Palermo and in Sicily. The society reacted to that, and it reacted beautifully.
How?
Well, there was a period right after that that we call the Spring of Palermo, which is in fact the one of which I have more memories, because I grew up in this city after those bombings, where All of a sudden, everybody was organizing cultural events. There was a vitality. Everybody was hanging at their balcony those white sheets with the portraits of Falcone and Borsellino. As I told you, it was interesting to grow up in this Palermo that was suddenly waking up. My mother was, we were always going together to these street demonstrations against mafia. I remember at least two of them.
How many years did it last?
Few years, 10 maybe,
wow,
5 to 10
years.
That's
not a few years.
No, but then it faded out. It faded out completely. And now we are almost back at point zero. Why mafia in the first place grew and developed in Sicily? Because institutions have been neglecting southern Italian regions. So when the institution are neglecting up to this extent, the skepticality toward institutions grows again, the clientelism grows again. So nothing was done at an institutional level to promote and keep that thing rolling as the normality. It was again, okay, whatever. Italian tends to forget very easily about their history. Very easily. Yeah, it makes me as well skeptical and negative. And, you know, I'm going to kind of surrender to what's going on. I left, as a matter of fact. This is the highest proof of my surrendering, you know, just... fuck it. So it's well known that right after those explosions there was a negotiation between mafia and part of the institutions. This is history. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's known that this happened.
And they tried to negotiate a truce?
No, not at all. So what happened is that the terrorist component of mafia had to go. And institutions tried to negotiate with mafia in order to stop the violence in change of something, of course. And as a matter of fact, after those two bombings, that was not one drop of blood for 25 years. In the 80s, every day there was something happening. So after those bombs, mafia got quiet again. Paolo Borsellino, before dying, before being killed, was doing his investigations about the connection between Sicilian mafia and North Italy entrepreneurs that were rising in that period, one of all Silvio Berlusconi. It is proved that the right arm of Silvio Berlusconi, who's now in jail himself, was the connective element between mafia and Berlusconi. That was about to become an extremely powerful man. At the national level, I think that if that compromise between mafia and the state wouldn't have happened, the war would have just continued, I suppose. With which outcomes, I don't know. But maybe we wouldn't have had Berlusconi. Most likely we wouldn't have had Berlusconi.
That's a big difference.
But maybe somebody worse than him would have been there. So, I don't know, but certainly I don't know what if. I read news every day of Calabrian mafia or Sicilian mafia having connection with the drug industry in the Netherlands.
And on you? De Mafia, Italiaanse maffia is in Europa zeer
actief. In Amsterdam is gisteravond een Italiaanse maffiabaas gearresteerd. Hij is de hoofdverdachte van een zesvoudige moord in
Duitsland. De Italiaanse maffia krijgt in Nederland steeds meer voet aan de grond. U heeft het vandaag al eerder kunnen horen tegen een speciaal team van de Nederlandse politie moet in gaan bestrijden. Daarover ga ik het hebben met het hoofd van de Nederlandse recherche Wilfried Paulussen en met Italië-correspondent Pauline Falkenet.
In een Zandvoort verbleef blijkt een kopstuk van de Italiaanse maffia. Te zijn.
Heerlijke pizza's.
Pizza Margarita.
Ja. Een klein terrasje buiten op de trottoir en dat zat echt iedere avond vol.
Hij kwam ook regelmatig met een glaasje wijn aan tafel zitten. En dus het was echt een soort buurtfiguur geworden.
Maar hij had hier dus een fantastisch leven.
Absoluut. Ja. En we zullen hem ook heel erg gaan missen.
What drives me crazy is that, and what concerns me the most, is that people in the Netherlands doesn't give a fuck about this. This is what drives me crazy. That people still treats this matter in the best case scenarios with total indifference, and in the worst case scenario, they even think that's not relevant or that doesn't exist or that, which is actually what mafia needs in order to prosper. You know, so what drives me crazy more than the fact that those phenomena are taking place is that the people doesn't give a damn. I've never heard anybody asking me a question. I would be glad if somebody would come to me and ask me some questions about mafia that are some real, that are connected to reality, rather than asking me, but if I go to the street in Palermo, then they shoot me. Vito, you understand?
Yeah.
What is the biggest misconception that you feel that you hear around you?
About mafia?
Yeah.
That it's a fictional phenomenon. Or even worse, that it's a fascinating phenomenon. You know? I always say that people treat mafia as it's a Star Wars. With the same kind of cult, you know. I love the Godfather, but I mean, the Godfather is a fucking movie. It is already branded to something that can be sold as a cultural product, as a food product, as a clothing product, it's a brand that is totally disconnected with reality. It's insane.
Did you know that this was the attitude before you left Sicily?
No.
Other Sicilian friends of you, do they have the same experiences?
No, everybody.
Everyone. Do you think we are naive?
No. Naive is a too diplomatic term. People is ignorant. Ignorant. Naive is another thing. Misinformed. Uninterested, not naive. So Europe is a unified or a unifying reality, at least for what concerns criminality. If people doesn't acknowledge this system of criminality will get stronger.
Thank you.
just needed to change the situation, to change the conversation.
Well, to get together and to open to each other, to listen to each other and to speak openly. That's one step. I don't know if that's going to be enough, but that's what we can do at our level.
Is there anything that gives you hope?
Look, there is a quote from Giovanni Falcone that for some Sicilians is a sort of mantra, that mafia is a human phenomenon, and as all human phenomenon, it had a beginning, it has a development, and it will come to end, as all human phenomenon. As I said, what we can do is to speed up the process as much as possible. But what triggers me the most is to watch or read about it. When I see an interview of Giovanni Falcone, it's always very strong when I hear him talking, because I can understand every single word, and I immediately think that I heard the bomb that killed that man.
This show was brought to you by Resonate Productions. We make musical journalism on emotional blind spots in society. Many thanks to all the musicians who donated their songs to help to tell this story. Alfio Antico, Giulia Tagliavia, Francesco Guiana, and Salvatore Bonafede. You can find all of them on facebook.com/musicaljournalism. See you next time.